Well, we got as many remotes in the pulpit as we do in my home. Good to see you this morning. Glad that you are here. You're an encouragement to me. It's been good to worship together this morning. Appreciate your presence. And to those who are visiting with us this morning as well, you are a great source of joy to us. We have been blessed by your participating in our worship, the gift of your presence. And we do hope this morning that if this is your first time here at Climb, but it won't be your last. And to that end, we want to do whatever we can to make you feel welcome, comfortable. Avail yourselves of us, ask us any questions you have, share any concerns you may have with us. We'd like to know a little bit more about who you are and what brought you our way. If you're comfortable sharing yourself with us, and you can do that by saying something to somebody on the way out this morning or leaving a visitor's card behind. Those visitor's cards are available in the visitor's packs that are located at all three exits of the auditorium, and we'd love to hear from you. We're thankful for you and glad that you are here and with us this morning. Well, this morning's one of those mornings where you find out who remembered to set their clock forward. You know, in the fall, nothing happens except you show up early if you forget to change your clock. In the spring, you forget to change your clock, you miss everything. But it's good to see you here this morning, and good to be worshiping God together. Colossians chapter 3, you got your Bible now, Colossians 3. Let me begin reading together, starting in verse 1. Apostle Paul says this. He says, "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry." And you drop down to the verse 10 where he kind of gets to the end of this section and this unit. He'll say, kind of to summarize it all, he'll say, "Put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator." If you've been raised with Christ, Paul says, you need to seek, you need to look for, you need to think about different things. It's a sharp contrast that the Apostle Paul makes here in these opening verses to Colossians, in which he twice basically encourages Christians to seek the things that are above and set your minds on the things that are above, to the neglect, to the removal of that which is from below, that which is earthly. In fact, Paul goes even so far as to say, you need to put those things to death. That's stark language. We maybe have gotten a little bit familiar with it because we're used to the Bible and we read the Bible a lot. We're used to the Bible's idioms, but really let that sink in what the Bible is saying there this morning, that basically you need to put to death. That's a radical action that Paul is calling for there, a radical action to change the course of your life. We, by nature in the world, we who have grown up in a poison, toxin culture, are naturally affected and infected by worldly things, worldly ideas and worldly actions, things that are from below, the lower things. But Paul says when we become Christians, we are set apart for, we are called to the higher things. And that's what we seek, and that is where we set our mind. I want to suggest to you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, though, that one of the things that often becomes a challenge for Christians, especially over the long term, is that we become complacent and self-satisfied because we begin to think that because we don't do things that are actively and obviously wrong, that we are where we need to be. We define Christianity primarily by what we are not. We are not fornicators. We are not idolaters. We're not terribly covetous. We're not overly greedy. And we begin to define our Christianity by what we are not, whereas we fail to take full stock of what Paul is saying here, that part of what it means to be a Christian is that we seek and we set our minds on higher things. We don't just avoid the lower things. Too often we may well ignore the worst of the earthly things, but still be satisfied with ourselves as we're not fully pursuing the higher things, the things for above. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I will make one other side observation this morning, that a lot of times we may not be pursuing the worst of the earthly things, and we may not be actively involved in the worst of the earthly things. But when we are not fully seeking the higher things, we are still worldly. We are still satisfied by the lower things. We are still comfortable with some level of worldliness. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that immaturity and worldliness are a great spiritual risk that can lead to our downfall. When we become complacent in our spiritual immaturity, that is its own soft form of worldliness, its own contentment with less than the higher things that God has called us to. In a few minutes that I have together with you this morning, I want to make three quick observations about what it means to seek the things above, to seek the higher things, as Paul's talking about here in Colossians, to change what we seek and how we think so that we don't just avoid the bad stuff, so that we're not just complacent in our own spiritual mediocrity and our immaturity, which is its own soft form of worldliness, but that we truly leave behind the earthly for the higher things. Let me make three quick observations in the few minutes that we have together this morning, and then our time will be through. Number one, what it means to seek the things above is that, number one, we seek wisdom instead of rights. We seek wisdom instead of rights. In other words, we learn, ladies and gentlemen, we learn to seek to be wise instead of exercising our rights. Sometimes I meet somebody who's caught in some sort of cycle of spiritual immaturity in their life. Maybe they're not doing something that's overtly and explicitly sinful, but maybe they're just doing something that puts them well on the path towards spiritual ruin if they're not careful. Maybe sometimes I'm dealing with somebody who is living right on the line between the world's ways and God's ways. They are edging themselves up to the line that God doesn't want us to cross. And a lot of times when you try to talk to somebody who's living that way, in their spiritual immaturity, they'll sit there and say, well, technically, Jeff, I'm not doing anything that's wrong, and technically, there may be right. But I will tell you, Paul made it very clear in his work that when it comes to living rightly and well, part of what it means to seek the higher things is that we learn to live wisely and not just rightly. Oh, it's important to be right, but it's even more important, biblically speaking, to be wise about what we do. That's why Paul repeatedly says to the Corinthians, those foolish and mediocre Christians as they were, he says in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12, he says, all things are lawful for me. Not that he literally believed that was true, but his point was, if you're obsessed with what your rights are, not all things are helpful. Not all things are, in the classic translation, expedient. Not all things lead to upbuilding. All things may be lawful. You may be concerned about your rights and where the lines are, Paul says. As long as I don't cross the actual line between right and wrong, I'm okay. But the apostle makes very clear that that's really not the highest consideration for the Christian. Indeed, he comes back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23, a few verses later, a few pages later, and says the same thing. He says, all things are lawful, but not all things are helpful. They don't make you a better person. They don't connect you to the higher things. You live in the language of rights. You pursue living at the edge of what is permissible before God. And I'll tell you what, that's really keeping yourself one hairbreadth away from the things of this world in their fullness. We've got to learn, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to learn as Christians that it's not enough just to not be wrong. It's not enough as a Christian not to just not be wrong. We need to be right. We need to not just be earthly. We've got to seek the higher things, Paul says. Indeed, Paul even says this. He says, basically, this becomes such a motivating factor in who we are and how we live. In the 2 Corinthians 12, as he's bringing that letter to an end, so much of that letter, especially in its later chapters, is devoted to the Apostle Paul. And it's just describing all his apostolic sufferings, all the work that he has done. On the surface level, apparently, to basically help the Corinthian Christians understand that he really is a real apostle. Some have denied Paul's apostleship. They've torn down his reputation. The Apostle Paul, he admits he feels kind of foolish and stupid doing it. They basically have to brag about his apostleship, but he makes clear when he gets to 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 19, even in bragging, in a sense, and talking about the scope and scale of his sufferings and his works as an apostle, he says in verse 19 of 2 Corinthians 12, have you been thinking all along that we've been defending ourselves to you? You think I'm just doing this for ego's sake, Paul asks? No, rather, he says, it is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ and all for your upbuilding, beloved. Even when I have to toot my own horn, it's not for my ego. Why do I do it? I do it because it's wise. It's good for somebody else. It's good for you. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I, we've got to learn to live wisely. And part of what it means to live wisely is that we learn to live in such a way where we think about how things impact others and what we do. Maybe I have a right to do something, but maybe my observance of my right to do something is going to put somebody else in spiritual peril, put them at risk. Listen to what Paul said in Romans 15, beginning of verse 1. He said, we who are strong, we who know what our rights are, we who are strong ought to have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For Christ did not please himself, But as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. And there in so doing, when he speaks of Christ not pleasing himself but fulfilling Scripture, he's quoting from Psalm 69 there. But let me tell you what's going on in Psalm 69 from which Paul quotes. When he says, see, this is how Christ lives. What Paul gets at when he quotes from Psalm 69, Psalm 69, the larger context, reads this way. Psalm 69, the psalmist speaking in the first person says, Let not those who hope in you, speaking of God, let not those who hope in you be put to shame through me, O Lord God of hosts. Let not those who seek you be brought to dishonor through me, O God of Israel. For it is for your sake that I've borne reproach, that dishonor has covered my face. I have become a stranger to my brothers, an alien to my mother's sons. For zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. In other words, what the psalmist is saying there is that his life is girded around and framed by and based upon not what are his rights to enjoy life or seek his own happiness. His life is founded in a thorough and personal self-identification with God's cause. We lose ourselves in God's purposes and God's glory. The psalmist says, zeal for your house has consumed me. The reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen upon me. I take it personally when people speak against God. My life is so thoroughly identified with God, his things, his ways. See, that's what Paul's getting when he says, listen, that's how Jesus lives. Not to please himself, not about his rights or his prerogatives. He lives wisely before his God and makes it all about his God. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I, when it comes to right living, we got to understand there's a wiser way to live rather than just knowing where the lines are, knowing what our rights are. All things may be lawful, Paul says, but not all things are expedient. There's a better way to think than just, is it okay to do this? We think about others. We think about God's glory. I love the way the wise man puts it at the very beginning of the book of Proverbs when it comes to thinking about wisdom and what it means to be wise. He says this in Proverbs 1, beginning of verse 2. He says that the goal is to know wisdom and instruction, to understand words of insight, to receive instruction in wise dealing and righteousness and justice and equity, to give prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the youth. Being wise includes seeing things rightly and well. It begins learning that just because something may be legal and technically this side of the boundary doesn't mean it's good to do it. To be wise means that we see things the way they are, that we see things the way that God sees it, that we see the world the way God sees it. To be wise means that we discern and that we understand what things really are and where things actually lead. It means that we see things for what they are, that we see things for where they may lead. To be wise means that we see the substance of things and we see the substance of people below the surface appearance. Even the same opening of Proverbs, by the time you get to chapter 7, basically the powerful story that the wise man relates in Proverbs 7 about the young man who dies in the adulterous embrace of the married woman is basically a young man who doesn't see the world for what it is. He's blind to the dangers around him, the young fool. Learning to see situations and people and things below the surface appearance of benign acceptability. To be wise means seeing reality without being blinded or misled by the influence of relationships or sympathy or a misguided sense of compassion or a mistaken sense of loyalty. Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. When it comes to seeking the higher things, if we learn to put wisdom above our rights, if we learn to do what is wise, biblically speaking, you will never have to worry about doing what is right in God's sight. If we learn to be wise people, we will never have to worry about doing what is right. In fact, again, in Proverbs 1, do you know this? Do you notice how the wise man there, from the very beginning of his considerations and meditations upon what it means to be wise before God, it's not just to basically give understanding and prudence and discretion, though it does that, but to receive instruction in wise dealing and righteousness, justice, and equity. Biblical wisdom naturally leads to righteousness, but sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, we stop too soon and we set the bar too low. We need to move the goal back a step. We need to step back from the ledge of wrongdoing, from living on the edge, from living at the line of right and wrong, and we need to learn to do what's wise and rather than saying, I have a right to be where I'm at. You want to make a real difference in your life and you really want to live for, seek, and think the higher things? Don't ask whether something you want to do is wrong. Better question, ask what's right about what you want to do. That's wisdom. And that's what it looks like to seek the higher things. That's what maturity in Christianity looks like. We don't ask what's wrong with it. We ask what's right about it. You learn to do that and do that consistently and courageously, it'll change how you live. I promise you that. And so when it comes to seeking the things above, number one, we need to learn to seek wisdom instead of our spiritual rights. Number two, very quickly. Number two, though, we need to understand the significance and the power of influence. We need to understand the significance and the power of influence. Take, for example, the issue of modesty in dress. Modesty in dress. When the Bible talks about modesty in dress, ironically, Paul's not worried about, like in 1 Timothy chapter 2, for instance, Paul's not really worried about people being underdressed or undressed, showing too much of their body. The paradox is in their time and place, Paul was more worried about in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Paul was more worried about people showing too much, basically overdressing for the occasion. And the point was, as Paul writes in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9, that likewise women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, restraint, not braiding hair, gold, pearls, or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. What Paul's getting at there is basically not, by the way, that's necessarily literally wrong to wear jewelry today. What he's getting at is when you are obviously overdressed for the occasion that you're in, when you are obviously showing off that you have more than others around you. You need to think about, in other words, what Paul says, when it comes to think about your modesty and your dress, the real spiritual value of modesty and dress, what Paul's saying is this. You need to think about how what you wear affects other people. That's the point. When you show up and you show how much you've got, because you've got the best clothes in the congregation and you've got the nicest and most jewelry, what are you saying to others in the congregation who don't have as much? How are you making them feel in the assembly? When we ought to be thinking about God's things, people are becoming self-conscious about what they don't have compared to what you do. Modesty, whether it's overdressing or whether it's underdressing, it's basically all about thinking about how what I wear is going to influence somebody else. I have a right to wear it, Jeff. It's not my fault other people lust, or it's not my fault other people covet, whichever extreme we want to talk about. Well, yeah, that's right. They should guard their hearts, but you should love them enough and understand influence. When we seek the higher things, we're all about the influence that our lives have upon others. That's part of what it means to think the higher things in the higher way. And so I'm not going to do anything in my life that's going to unnecessarily hurt relationships. I'm not going to do anything in my life that makes me an unnecessary distraction. Because I'm aware of how my self-presentation, my life, and my lifestyle are going to influence others, regardless of whether I have the right to do something or whether I have the right to wear something as I see it. I know that what I do impacts other people. Because I recognize at the end of the day, it's not about my right. It's about wisdom, and it's about God's glory. I think, ladies and gentlemen, one of the biggest things that we as God's people have got to recover in our understanding is it's not about my rights. It's about God's glory. All of our lives are about God's glory, not our self-satisfied enjoyment. It's kind of interesting. In Zechariah chapter 7, God even calls out his people once upon a time on this very issue. In Zechariah 7, beginning of verse 5, he says, "Say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and when you mourned in the fifth month and in the seventh for these 70 years, was it really for me that you fasted? And when you eat and when you drink, do you not eat for yourselves and drink for yourselves?" Don't you get it? God says, I see what you're doing even in your worship. You live for yourself. Even your worship, you find a way to make about you. You make your life about yourself, God says. And while I want you to enjoy my gifts, there's still a way in which our enjoyment can become selfish. We become comfortable with the earthly and with the lower. We lose track of the higher. Which is why Paul in 1 Corinthians 10 will come back and say, whether you eat or you drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Ladies and gentlemen, he's not just talking about in the assembly when he writes that. That's a principle for life, period. Whatever you do, eat, drink, whatever it is in your daily life, in the assembly, out of the assembly, on Monday as much as on Sunday, all of life is for God's glory. And if it's for God's glory, that means I'm going to have to think about my influence and how my influence affects God's glory, God's reputation, God's appearance to the world, how it affects other people's ability to bring and give glory to God. What that means is that what God is offering us and expecting us, of us, is for us to learn that a real and true joy that lasts is found in sacrificial service to God and to others instead of the shallow happiness of the selfish life led in the pursuit of my rights and instant gratification, all based in the lower things. I think, ladies and gentlemen, we have to understand when it comes to seeking the higher things, we have to think about our influence. Sometimes people say, you know, in my own life, Jeff, I know how to hold the line. I won't cross the line. I can live at the line. I can hold the line. Yes, but what about your influence? Sometimes people say, I know how to hold the line, but my question is, what about your children? Or what about others who may be emboldened by your example to live at the line and therefore, because they're not as strong as you are, not as careful as you are, eventually cross the line? When it comes to seeking the higher things, we have to think about our influence and the role it has. Because here's something I've noticed, ladies and gentlemen. Here's something I have noticed, both in life and in watching people and families and congregations over time. And I've noticed it in the Bible as well. When it comes to the realm of influence, here's what happens. Is that the children in a family or the next generation in a group, that the children typically turn out just like their parents, but just a little bit less. Just a little bit less careful. Just a little bit less devoted, just a little bit less righteous, just a little bit less wise. The children will push the line just a little bit further than where their parents did. Oh, I see it in the Bible. I see it all around the Bible. Take the book of Genesis, for instance. Remember the story of the patriarchs? What was Abraham's great weakness? Abraham tended to get weak when his life was on the line. And so he traded his wife for his life. Did it more than once. Remember the story? It's kind of interesting, you look at the story. Abraham tells a half-truth. Technically, it wasn't even a lie. It was true. She was his sister of a sort. But Abraham tells a half-truth calculated to deceive, to save his life. But you go forward a generation. You know what his son Isaac does? He does the same, but even more so. Because now he says something that's a full-blown lie. She is my sister. Well, Rebecca was no such thing. She was not his sister at all. Isaac tells a whole lie, calculated to deceive, to save his life. But at least there was some sort of self-preservation in it. But go forward another generation. What happens with Jacob? Well, Jacob tells a whole lie. I'm Esau. And he does it repeatedly and forcefully to his father. Are you sure? Because you sound like Jacob. No, I'm Esau. Jacob tells a whole lie, repeatedly and forcefully, calculated to give himself nothing more than selfish advantage, not even to save his life, simply to get what he wants from his dad. Fast forward another generation. Then there's Joseph and his brothers. Remember what Joseph's brothers do? They deceive their father with the bloody coat. Why? Not even for personal advantage anymore, but simply out of sheer malice, hate, spite. You see how the feet of clay of Abraham, when it comes to telling the truth and taking our chances, spread further and further and further from generation to generation to generation. I'll tell you, those of us who are parents this morning, ladies and gentlemen, those who are parents, if there's ever a good reason not to live at the line and claim our rights as long as we're not technically wrong, that's it. Because my children will learn to set the line where I am and go a little bit further. That's what my children are going to learn. Children tend to be just a little bit less than their parents. And it goes from Abraham's half-truth to Isaac's whole lie, but at least he's just trying to save his life, to Jacob's rabid untruth for personal advantage, to Joseph's brothers actively trying to twist their father's mind because they hate their brother so much. Oh, look at the cancer spread from generation to generation as each generation moves a line one step further to whereas technically Abraham was telling something that was at least halfway true to now there's no truth and there's great wickedness from generation to generation. Oh, and that's not the only place you can see that happen in the Bible. What about on the group level? Book of Judges. Here's what happens in the book of Judges chapter 1. You want to talk about the power of influence, ladies and gentlemen? Look what happens in the book of Judges. In Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1 tells one version of the account of Israel's conquest going into the promised land. And in Judges chapter 1 and verse 19, the way the text reads in verse 19 of Judges 1, it shows that Judah takes the hill country. When verse 21, it shows that Benjamin takes the hill country, but lets the Jebusites stay. Remember what they were supposed to do with the inhabitants of the land, though? What were they supposed to do with the inhabitants of the land? Destroy them, wipe them out, leave no remnant. Judah takes the hill country. Benjamin lets the Jebusites dwell among them. In verse 22 of Judges chapter 1, we read this, that the house of Joseph went up against Bethel. And the Lord was with them. But they, verse 24, saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, please show us the way into the city, and we will deal kindly with you. They're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to slaughter them all. And the man basically does that. He helps them find their way into the city to destroy it. And so they let the man and all his family go. You know what that man does? Verse 26, he now goes out, not just doesn't just dwell among them. He goes out and establishes a city. In the Hittite realm, to be sure, but establishes a city that the book of Judges goes on as this detail that is still there to this day. The city of the pagans will last longer than the cities of some of the Israelites because they failed to deal with driving out the wrongdoers. Verse 27, the Canaanites live among Manasseh. Verse 29, the Canaanites live among Ephraim. Verse 30, the Canaanites live among Zebulun. But in verse 31, notice there's a change in the language now. In verse 31 of Judges 1, you know what happens with the language? We've been going on so much with they let the Canaanites live among them, that now the verbiage changes in a very important way in verse 31. Now Asher is said to live among the Canaanites. Well, that's a stunning rhetorical shift, isn't it? Now it's no longer the Canaanites are tolerated among the people of God, but now it's the people of God live where they live among the Canaanites. And verse 33, Naphtali lives among the Canaanites. Verse 34 gets to the point where now the tribe of Dan is driven out by the Amorites. Now we've gone so far to where we've gone from, you see the progression we've gone from, we tolerated them among us, to now we're among them, to now they're the ones dictating terms to us. But here's where it gets really powerful. Beginning of Judges chapter 2 is really the end of Judges chapter 1. And the commentary works this way. So the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I'll never break my covenant with you. You shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land. You shall break down their altars. But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? In other words, you've let them stay, and now it's more you're among them than even we could rightfully say they're among you. And so the people wept. But what happens in chapter 2 and verse 6 is it steps back to the God's eye angle. And look at what chapter 2 and verse 6 says about this whole sad situation. It goes back to when the conquest was over. And so Joshua dismissed the people. And the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elder who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, he died, and they buried him with the boundaries of his inheritance. Verse 10, look at what happens. And all that generation were gathered to their fathers, and there arose after them a generation who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the evil did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. See what happens, ladies and gentlemen? See, the conquest generation doesn't do its job. It lives at the line. They don't actually drive out the Canaanites. In fact, they get to the point where they're dwelling among the Canaanites. But you know what? The text makes clear that, you know what, that first generation, as long as Joshua's alive, that first generation, that conquest generation that did not fully drive out the Canaanites, that compromised with the earthly things, they were able to hold the line. They were able to stay faithful. But what happened to their children who inherited that same environment? Their children did not. Their children could not. You sit there and you say, oh, Jeff, I know where the line is in my own life. I won't cross it. That's good for you. I'm glad for you. What about your children? What about those for whom you have influence? Oh, Jeff, I know that I'm on the line here, but I'm technically not over the line. You can't tell me I can't. Good for you. But what about those who come behind you? The first generation could handle it. Pretty clear their children could not. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me ask you this morning. Let's be real frank and let's be real personal. What are the earthly things that we participate in that we think about, I know where the line is, and I'll live right at the line. You can't tell me technically I'm wrong, Jeff. I'm not going to cross it, and you can't tell me I can't. What about something like drinking? Oh, listen, Jeff, I know the Bible makes very clear drunkenness is wrong. I get that. I don't get drunk. And I understand the problems with social drinking. I understand the problem, as Peter makes clear in 1 Peter 4. I understand the problem with social drinking. I get that there's a problem with being part of that scene and part of that world and and being a part of happy hour and the carousing and all that goes on. I get that, Jeff. I hear you. I don't participate in that. But you know what? There's nothing wrong with keeping a couple of beers in my refrigerator because technically, there's nothing wrong with just a little bit of alcohol. Listen, I won't argue with you this morning about whether it's right or wrong in and of itself. I won't argue with you about that this morning. I'll just simply ask you this. I'll ask you, what about your influence? What about your children in your house who know what's in your refrigerator? You know how to hold the line. You don't carouse, good for you. You don't get drunk, good for you. Let me ask you about what's going to happen in the next generation with your children who know what you've got at home. Because I've seen it in the Bible, and I've seen it in life. You know how to live on the line, good for you. I can almost guarantee you your children will not. I'll simply ask you this. If sharing in something that at some frequent level is so totally owned by the world as drinking is, what makes you think that those are going to come after you're going to be able to hold the line that you think you're holding right now? What about dancing? What about dancing? You say, oh, Jeff, you listen, there's nothing technically wrong with dancing. It can be an art form. It can be something that's good and beautiful. It doesn't have to be lascivious and worldly in that sense. And okay, fine, for the sake of argument, I won't argue that with you. And I get the power of music. There's something natural about it. All of us have caught our foot tapping sometimes. We're listening to a powerful, good song. Our foot begins to move. And all of us who've had little kids, we know the power of music. When music comes on and the kids want to dance around and get the wiggles out and all. And that's fine because there's something good and natural and innocent about that. But let's talk about what happens when we get older. And we begin to say, listen, I'm not doing anything that's lascivious and I'm not going to participate in anything that's lascivious, that's sensual. But I'm going to live at the line, Jeff, because you can't tell me there's anything that's technically, ultimately wrong about it. I'll just simply again ask you this. What's good in it? How are you improving your influence? What's wise about this? Maybe you can hold the line. Maybe you never really crossed the line, but how do you know what you're influencing, what you're maybe not influencing others to do? Maybe you, especially some of you young people, you can hold the line and you can guard your mind and your heart. You don't lust. You don't cross the line to how you move your body. And maybe you're not looking around at you and doing the same with anybody else. But let me tell you something. As you become parents of children down the road, how are your children going to hold the line? Because what I see in life, what I see in the Bible, is the next generation almost never does. Old Testament and New Testament, let me tell you what the concept of the Bible is, that each generation doesn't get to live for itself. Each generation receives God's word as an inheritance. And our job as a congregation, collectively, and as families individually, is to build up the spiritual capital for the next generation, to pass on a stronger spiritual life than what maybe we received from our parents, our grandparents, the congregations that we grew up in. Our job is to accumulate the spiritual capital, to pass on as an inheritance to the generation that comes behind us, not to squander it by living earthly things and lower things and living on the edge. You understand that this morning? We have received the word of God. We received a great inheritance. That was one of the things that the Old Testament Jews understood about the land. They received an inheritance. That's why Naboth would not sell his land to Ahab, even though Ahab offered him something better. He said, Naboth said to basically Ahab, it's not my land. It's an inheritance. It's a trust. And I've got to hand on to my descendants as good or better than what was given to me. And too often, ladies and gentlemen, you and I, we failed to do that when we seek the, and when we are satisfied with spiritual mediocrity, shallow worldliness, and the earthly things instead of seeking the things above. And number thirdly and finally this morning, what it means to seek the things above. That we need to develop spiritual substance instead of superficial actions. That we need to develop true spiritual substance instead of superficial actions. Back in Colossians chapter 3, it's kind of interesting what Paul does here. In Colossians chapter 3, as he begins to transition from that opening large-scale statement that he makes. In Colossians chapter 3, having basically said that we need to seek the things that are above, and we need to set our minds on the things that are above, that we need to put to death the earthly that is in us, the lower things, the base things that are in us. Verse 12, he says, this is what you do. You need to put on as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, patience, forbearance with one another, forgiveness. What you know is part of what Paul's getting at here. Paul is describing not deeds to be done. He's describing virtues and mindsets that control and constrain us. He's describing a spiritual version of wisdom is what he's offering us. Virtues and mindsets that will control us and have much broader application and implication for our lives than just what a list of do's and don'ts could ever provide. Put on, holy and beloved, compassionate, kind, humble, meek, patient, forbearing, forgiving hearts. And I want you to notice, by the way, in that list, how many of those descriptions or words or virtues Paul gives are ones that are focused upon others. See, it goes back to influence if we're going to live the things that are above. Kindness is others focused. Forgiveness is others focused. Compassion is others focused. Humility is how I see myself in relationship to others and how I treat others. Meekness is how I handle myself in relationship with others. Ladies and gentlemen, you and I, we need to understand that we need, as Paul put it once upon a time, become adults and put away the childish things, the simplistic things, the childish arguments about it's my right to do something. We need to seek the higher things through wisdom, through a serious reckoning with the scope and scale of our influence, and with a deep spiritual substance that wants to be truly Christian, Christ-like from the inside out. I like the way one writer put it once upon a time. He wrote this. He said, Christianity is more than a set of devotional practices and a moral code. It is also a way of thinking about God and about human beings and about the world and about history. In other words, how the world works, our place in it, and the fact that God's going to end the world and come back and judge it all. Christianity is not a moral code. Christianity is a worldview. It's a way of thinking. For Christians, thinking is part of believing. And that's what Paul's getting at, what we're talking about this morning, seeking the higher things, learning to think Christianly. That's why we need to set our minds on things above, the higher things. That's why we need character, a Christianity that flows from the inside out. We are new creatures, new creations, Paul says, that desires the higher things, the eternal things, the permanent things. And that means we need vision. We need wisdom. That means we need to take seriously the nature of influence. That means we've got to become spiritually substantive people rather than self-satisfied, mediocre ones. We need vision, the ability to see things for what they really are, to see things for where they can lead, to see our lives not just in terms of our own time, but in terms of the entire cosmic project throughout history that God in creation is working on. And to close this morning, we could do no better than what Paul says in Philippians 1. When he says, this is my prayer, verse 9, that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent. Diaphoronta. Literally, perhaps even better reason, not just things that are excellent, but the things that last, the things that are permanent, the things that will not pass away when the earthly in which we too often anchor ourselves does. The values and the satisfactions and the happiness that is tied to a certain kind of lifestyle for this kind of an age. Paul says, I pray that your love may abound with the goal that you may learn to truly approve the eternal things, the things that last, and so to be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. You do that, you'll be filled with the fruit of righteousness. You learn to live wisely. See, Paul's saying what we're saying this morning. You learn to live wisely. Seek the higher things. Approve the permanent things, the things that last. You'll be filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God, which again is the point anyways. God, help us to learn to have the wisdom and the insight to approve the things that last in a sick and crumbling world. To truly seek the higher things and not just be shallowly and superficially satisfied by avoiding the lower things. That's the goal. That's a version and a vision of Christian maturity. And God, help us to pursue that. You listened well and patiently this morning. Thank you for your indulgence. If you're here this morning, we want to offer you an opportunity before we bring this service to a close to give you the chance to get your life right with God. If you're here this morning, you understand
what the gospel is all about, you know the story of Jesus and what it means, and you're ready to change your life and shape your life on the basis of his work, his life, his death, his resurrection, and all of that means for how you're going to change and how you're going to live from this point forward. If you're ready this morning from the heart of faith and conviction to confess Jesus as the Son of God, repenting of your sins, we'll baptize you for the forgiveness of those sins. Maybe you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but your life is still corrupted by the earthly things. You've not pursued the higher things. You're complacent, you're mediocre. Maybe it's worse than that. Maybe you've actually crossed the line, you know it, God knows it. You're somewhere you shouldn't be. You lived on the line and fell across. And pray to God for forgiveness however you failed. And we can pray with you for you in some way, hold you accountable, talk with you, comfort you, hold you accountable.